Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we're in depth on what America First really means.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America First. America First.
You can put a lot of different lenses on the president's words. There's the historical context that links it to isolationism in the 1940s. Nicholas Burns, a former diplomat for both GOP and Democratic administrations, sees it as, quote, a retreat from American openness. Conservative columnist Jonah Goldberg says he worries about what that first means in the way that Trump will define America's best interests. Today, two guests to give us their view on what America First means, and I think it's important to hear yours, too. Is an American First policy something that the U.S. has always pursued, even if a president hasn't called it that? Or is President Trump positioning the U.S. in a different way? And what do you think the consequences of that may be? So is this something that America has always, our interests first, always pursued? Or is President Trump doing something different, positioning the United States in the global community in a different way? And what do you think the consequences of that might be? Here's the number, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, and our guest this hour, John Radson, is a professor of law at Mitchell Hamlin Law School, former assistant counsel to the CIA, and with me in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Carrie.
Peter Galbraith is with us. He's a former ambassador to Croatia, the author of Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies, and he's with us today from Gstaad, Switzerland. And Peter, welcome to you. It's really good to have you on the show as well.
Well, nice to be back with you.
John, is President Trump's declaration of America First open to interpretation, or is it pretty clear what he means when you hear him talk about the context of it?
It's open to interpretation, and I would answer your two questions in this way, that American foreign policy should have always been about America's interests first. I can't imagine any president from Washington to the present who would say that it's France first or Spain first. So I think he's emphasizing that our foreign policy needs to be consistent with American interests. People will debate about what is American interest, to think about the short term rather than the long term. I think, though, to agree with what has been stated, this is a very different approach. This is a different kind of rhetorical move. This is a different position, and it suggests a reevaluation of many of our relationships around the world and a different approach to protecting our borders and our openness to immigration. So there's a lot there to unpack.
So, Peter, to that interpretation first, just on the face of it, of America First, is this something that all presidents really pursue?
Well, James Baker, who was the Secretary of State for George H.W. Bush, when a new ambassador was appointed, he would or at least so the story goes, he would invite the American ambassador into his office and he'd say, "Now, could you show me on this globe here where your country is?" And of course, the right answer was for the ambassador to point to the United States, because that is your country, and that's what our foreign policy has always been about. So the issue is not... the issue is how you promote America First, whether you do it through cooperation, whether you do it through military intervention. We've had different approaches in recent years from the Bush administration and the unilateral action in Iraq, the father with the multilateral action on Kuwait, to Clinton with the multilateral action on Bosnia. And now Donald Trump has come up with a different definition. Now, listening to his inaugural speech, it sounds kind of, if you will, strident, and certainly there are reminiscences of the American Firsters who were basically following an appeasement line toward Hitler in the 1940s. On the other hand, the example he cited was we spending trillions of dollars defending or trying to shape other countries, and that what the Iraq War is a several trillion dollar war, and ignoring needs at home, and it's hard not to feel that he has a point there. So the real question is, what is going to be the content of his foreign policy? And it may be quite different. It certainly seems to be very close relations with Russia. A view that NATO is not a particularly important institution. He said it's obsolete. Whether that's translated into action or not, we'll see. But it could be some very substantially different direction. But it's no more America first than any other president, because that's always been the center of U.S. foreign policy. The question is, what does that mean?
Let's hear from some of our listeners and voters here to Tom in St. Paul. Tom, what does America first sound like to you?
Well, first of all, I think the president is being somewhat disingenuous when he says America first, because every sovereign nation obviously is going to place its national interests above others. But America first sounds like isolationism. And prior to World War I, we avoided getting involved in Europe's messy affairs. And that had disastrous consequences, not only because we ended up being in World War I at the tail end of it, but also that whole worldview wasn't in our national interest. So I'd like to hear your comments.
Sure.
About that.
Yeah, John, can you remove the historical context from this in the way that it sounds like Donald Trump is trying to do?
I don't think you can remove the context. I don't know that Donald Trump is trying to remove it. There is a reaction to the foreign policies of Obama, and I even hear a reaction to the foreign policy of George W. Bush. What I'd like to state is that this is not an either-or on these polls, is that we're talking about a continuum of American foreign policy. We're also going to examine the Trump foreign policy and ask ourselves, to what extent does he go between these poles? And let me lay out the poles, and I think this plays into what Peter was saying, is that we're going to ask ourselves, to what extent is the president going to be multilateral? Does he want to draw in our allies? Does he want to go to NATO, the United Nations? I suspect that Trump is going to be much more to the other end of that spectrum. He's going to be unilateral. But we've had unilateral action. We've had differences between President Bush's. The father was much more unilateral in going into Iraq than his son was, multilateral, I should say. And at times, we want a president that's brave enough to do what is necessary to protect the nation, that we don't have to wait for our allies to come along. We want to ask ourselves, to what extent is the foreign policy motivated by our idealism, our human rights? We can go back to Jimmy Carter, and that seemed to be a large part of his foreign policy. Carter would have said and did say that that was consistent with American interests, that human rights and democracy help us in the long term. To others, it seemed to be very squishy, that it didn't make sense, that we were not protecting our short-term interests. We were not doing deals with regimes that might not have been that palatable, but served our interests militarily and politically. So, other way of phrasing it makes a lot of sense to me. How open are we going to be to the world, or how close will we be? It's not going to be either or, but we'll see aspects of this in the various relations with countries or in the various issues that we're going to talk about today.
Peter, what it has sounded like, though, is that Donald Trump, and I'm going to play a little bit of an excerpt here from the inaugural speech that I think will bear this out, that he does not seem that interested in collaboration, as John just said, multilateralism. But that he also seems highly attuned to some kind of provocation, which is, I think, what makes people nervous about this idea of America first. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and I think you have a point. First, I'd say, in response to what John said, I think that the Trump's difference is much more clear against George W. Bush than actually against Barack Obama.
How so?
Well, first, he in his speech, he implicitly criticized the Iraq War and the enormous cost of it, that we had done all of that abroad, right, and ignored people at home. So on the one hand, I think it's a rejection of the multilateral approach and the human rights approach of the Democrats from Carter through Obama, but more strongly, I think it's a rejection of this very aggressive world role, which I think was embodied by George W. Bush. Now, I think what concerns a lot of people is actually Trump's behavior, that is responding to perceived insults on Twitter, or, you know, when you're, it's one thing when you're a private citizen or even a candidate responding on Twitter, but when you have nuclear launch codes and all the instruments of power, there's going to be a lot of people who will provoke the president of the United States. And I think it wasn't very encouraging that he spent his first few days, that he went over to the CIA on the first day, and focused on the size of the crowds at the inauguration. Mm-hmm. and how the press had misreported it. He has not been setting a tone that is going to have broad appeal for his administration, at least in the early days.
Joe says on Twitter, it evokes dangerous and discredited ideas that nations need to control resources and their borders to be safe and prosperous. Aaron says it means self-centeredness, lacking in empathy or compassion. And John, you wanted to say something back to what Peter is suggesting here.
I do. I think Peter has hit a very important point. We ask ourselves, what about Trump's temperament? What about his behavior, to use Peter's word? What we wonder about is how much of this is truly Donald Trump. If it is, I think we should be alarmed. We don't want a president that's easily provoked, that's going to make a decision right away without consulting his mechanisms within the National Security Council. We don't need him necessarily consulting our allies, but I think that's a good idea. I sometimes say to myself, maybe this is more act than reality. I hope that it is. And if that's the case, then it creates an uncertainty for our negotiating partners, and that may be consistent with our interests.
Not a bad thing if they're wondering what he really means and what the U.S. will do.
That's for sure. Let's look at some historic examples. I'll identify one. Nixon understood that he was viewed around the world as somebody that was easily provoked, unpredictable. If you read his statements about his time running foreign policy and Henry Kissinger's, they use this as a kind of good cop, bad cop. So we ask ourselves, how much of this is act? How much is true? Donald Trump is never going to tell us whether he's acting. That's part of maintaining the good role. One other point I would make, and I don't mean this as any offense toward Peter or others, is that a part of Trump's approach is that he does not trust the Foreign Service, career diplomats, people that speak several languages. He used during the campaign the idea of the pinstripe suits, these diplomats that have their fancy suits and French cuff shirts, and he's a different kind of person. And I don't know that he's wrong to be skeptical. We should be skeptical of all types of experts, including the experts that you invite into this studio.
Peter, skepticism for the diplomats like you who speak many languages and speak to us from Gstaad, Switzerland. What do you think?
Well, for Donald Trump to be playing the role of the plebeian with his suits and airplanes and all of that is, shall we say, a bit passing strange. I think that there are some good reasons to be skeptical about the foreign policy establishment. And frankly, here, I don't include so many of the professional diplomats whose job it is to implement decisions by the professional foreign policy establishment. And Trump has very much challenged that. Part of it is the view of the establishment to see Russia in a very negative light, to be opposed, for example, as the U.S. has been, to the independence of every country that every place that aspires for independence, wanting to hold together the Soviet Union, Yugoslavia. There are a lot of things that are done because they've always been done that way. And to the extent that Trump might shake some of that up, it could be it could be positive. But I think the questions, I don't see in Trump so far a Nixonian cleverness of the good cop, bad cop. And incidentally, although Nixon sort of used that to justify himself after the fact, Nixon had his own demons that significantly motivated his behavior. But I don't see any of that. What really comes across is impulsive behavior, watching the news, tweeting immediately afterwards. Mm-hmm. Already he's threatened to cut over the Obama vote on the Jerusalem resolution or the settlements resolution to cut funding to the UN, denounce the organization as a no action when in fact it's deployed in some of the most dangerous places in the world. So what that's what a lot of people see. And I don't see any real good coming from that.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, about trying to understand the different interpretations that people are bringing to Trump's declaration of America First. He talked about this in the inaugural. He talked about it in a number of different campaign speeches. How is it seen within the United States by voters, by people that both support and oppose Donald Trump? And how is it seen in the rest of the world? Peter Galbraith is one of our guests this morning. He's a former U.S. ambassador, and he's the author of Unintended Consequences. John Radson with us, a professor of law at Mitchell Hamlin and a former assistant counsel to the CIA. I'm asking you this morning, is an American First policy something that the U.S. has always pursued, even if a president hasn't called it that? And our two guests have given their thoughts on that. Or is President Trump positioning the United States in a different way? And what do you think the consequences will be of that? And I'm just going to, I'll put the number out here, but I'm going to share something that the Vice Chancellor of Germany said about that. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieNPR. John, just a quick note here that Sigmar Gabriel, the Vice Chancellor of Germany, said when he heard President Trump's inaugural speech, and specifically this America First, he called it a drastic radicalization, his terms, in American politics, and that Berlin would be prepared to step into the vacuum that an inward-facing America would create. Well, those are some geopolitical consequences here that I wonder if President Trump has thought about.
I'm not sure that the United States, independent of who the president is, could play that global role that people expected coming out of World War II. We talked about the disappearance of a bipolar world, the United States and the Soviet Union. We've moved to a multipolar world. It's true that Trump wants to retrench even more than Clinton would have, and that creates a void. And other countries will step in. And if Germany wants to play a more responsible and global role, I think Trump would welcome that. We don't want the more negative powers, China, to be meddling and playing that global role. And I think you've identified that's one relationship that will change radically, the relationship between the United States and the European Union. Trump is keeping his promise on that. He has Theresa May coming in to talk about that special relationship that we have. And he's made clear that he doesn't think the Europeans are carrying their weight in NATO and other places. So we're going to have a reassessment there. We're going to have a reassessment in our relationship with Mexico. Trump said this during the campaign. He's issuing executive orders that are consistent with that, that he believes that protecting the border, protecting our laws, the immigration laws, that that is more important than this free flow that has always been part of our idea of democracy and our place in the world. And then I'd add one more. He's made clear that he does not think that Japan or South Korea are necessarily paying their way in getting nuclear protection.
I think he's called them free riders.
Free riders,
he?
And he's added Saudi Arabia to that. And I think it's great that we have a reassessment. Is that the problem with conventional wisdom is that it doesn't get tested enough. And we're going to test a lot of these assumptions in the next days and weeks ahead with this new president.
Call here from Sam in Minneapolis. Hi, Sam. Thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you very much. I think one thing that needs to be talked about is beyond America First. I think the undertone of it is Americans first. And I think what's important to define is in the context of Donald Trump and the people that really rallied behind him, what do they define as an American? And I think by conventional definition, I am an American. I was born and raised in Springfield, Illinois, to Indian-born parents. But I think the conversation has changed dramatically such that if you're not of European heritage, if you're not white, and everybody else is going to look at you with suspicion, and you're not an American anymore. And I think there's a dramatic undertone of that, and I feel it now more so than I ever have in the 45 years of my life. And I think that's an important thing to discuss here beyond the policy implications.
Sam, it's a really good point. I'm really glad you called. And Peter, what Sam is reminding us of is the America First declarations don't come in a vacuum either, that we've heard a lot about what Donald Trump has to say about a lot of different people, including people that come over the border and people that come from different backgrounds. When you add that to the context, Does this raise the same kind of concerns that you're hearing from someone like Sam?
Well, I think Sam raises a separate point, which is extremely important. I mean, we have in the appointments that Donald Trump has made the whitest and most male cabinet since Ronald Reagan. And more importantly, there's a kind of division in this country. As we know, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by nearly 3 million votes. So that the people who were disenfranchised, as it were, the majority were those who tended to live on the coasts, actually a place like Minnesota as well. And those populations tend to be more diverse they're less white, more diverse than other parts of the country. And that, over the long term, risks creating a great deal of tension. And in other countries, it's actually led to the division of the country. Now, I don't see that in the next 10 years, but if you think out to the end of the century, who knows? And people who are not white don't feel that they're being fairly represented, even through the electoral process, that's a problem. I wanted to go back to John's point about U.S. leadership, because the U.S. has gone a long way by the perception that around the world that we are the leader, and other countries have been unwilling to step forward. I think increasingly they are. What was said about Germany taking the lead is one point. In his first executive order, one of his first, Donald Trump basically said the U.S. would not fund organizations that promote or provide information about abortion in terms of family planning. Right away, the Dutch came along and said, okay, fine, we'll make up the deficit. Mm. Well, that means, of course, that mm-hmm. the U.S. position has no effect except right. to make the United States feel good. And I think we're going to see more of it. And one of the places we're seeing it most remarkably is Syria, where Russia, Iran, and Turkey held a meeting in Astana in Kazakhstan with the Syrian government and opposition, no American presence, and where Russia basically is taking the lead. And Donald Trump actually seems quite content to have Russia take the lead there. And incidentally, I don't think he's wrong. If the Russians can solve this, and if they get a base or two more in Syria, it's not going to do any harm to American interests.
Peter, I want to ask you something, because I really take what John said to heart about it is not a bad thing to have conventional wisdom tested every now and then. We're in that place right now, right? I mean, without immediately jumping to the worst kind of conclusion about this, we're in a time when you push back on the conventional wisdom, we're going to see what happens on that. And that's not a bad thing, is it?
No. I mean, why do we have to solve every problem? Why can't the Russians solve Syria? Why can't they be engaged? In many ways, their interests there are not so diametrically opposed to ours. They're opposed to the Sunni extremism that we worry about. Why not let the Germans play a larger role? Maybe we'll challenge the conventional wisdom when it comes to the emergence of new states. There's mm-hmm. Somaliland, which has broken away from Somalia, unrecognized for 30 years. Kurdistan, which is likely to vote for independence this year. The traditional American approach has been to oppose all of that. So maybe we'll see something different. In fact, in some of these cases, I hope we do. But my concern is, I mean, it's a good thing to test the conventional wisdom, but it's not necessarily a good thing to test it in all ways, and if your response to crises or to provocations is impulsive, when you're
exactly.
president of the United States, that is worrisome. When you come out without apparently a lot of thought and say it would be a great idea if Japan and South Korea got nuclear weapons, you know that's concerning. And then more broadly, as John raised the issue of China, if you actually carry through with your economic policies and trade wars, you know, we may send the world into a global recession, as indeed the trade wars of the 1930s contributed significantly to the worldwide depression.
Let me do this. I do want to come back to China, because there's a lot. There's some other implications here, just besides what he's been saying about trade. But I want to hear from Debbie in Duluth here. She called in to say, as a Jewish person, when I hear America First, It reminds me of Charles Lindbergh and his rhetoric. It's based on real history and anti-Semitism. Trump can pretend he doesn't know it's loaded, but it's loaded and dangerous. And to Steve in Brainerd. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. How are you today?
Doing good. Tell me what you're good. Thinking about in this discussion.
Well, I was just listening. One gentleman was on there and saying, you know, because he's Indian background, that he feels that that he's not included in this. I'm a white male, living in this country, born in this country.
Uh-huh.
And as I listen to Trump talk, I don't hear ethnic there. I certainly don't feel that it's just white only. No, that's not at all what I hear. It's our borders and our country needs to come together as all ethnics, not just white. And I think the gentleman just maybe has some insecurities you need to deal with. That's all.
John, what would you say to that?
Steve took some of my point. I was going to respond back to Sam's call in here. There is an interplay, as your callers are reminding us, between foreign policy and domestic policy. What we say overseas makes people feel differently here within the United States. What I ask myself is, here, my parents are immigrants. They come from a Muslim country. They come from Iran, which is not popular in the American psyche. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel that this president or these policies are coming after me. I don't think I'm naive. I don't think I'm delusional. I have a different reaction from the reaction that's been described. I'm privileged. I'm not on the front lines the way some recent immigrants are, but I think that we need to be more open-minded and to hear it. Not automatically say that there's nothing nefarious to it, but not come to the most negative conclusion right away.
Can I just ask you something? Because I know a bit about your background and your parents. That your father's a physician.
That's
right. They came here
1962,
decades ago, right?
That's right.
Do you think they would have, if it was today and they were trying to come into the United States and Donald Trump was president, would the United States have been welcoming to them? Do you think your parents have asked themselves that?
They have asked themselves that, and we talk about it a lot. And some of it is the way that Americans greet us, and that may have changed. I take your point. Much of it is on the immigrants of what we're going to do. How far are we going to make an effort to assimilate? And I think there is a responsibility in both ways, to learn about the country, to learn the language, to talk about us and not them, to accept that you are now part of this great country and you have these opportunities. And when people treat you in a way that is negative or prejudiced, not to assume that everybody views you that way or that this has been decided on high.
It's fair enough. Do you think your parents would have gotten the chance to assimilate if it was today and they were trying to come out of Iran and you know, get a visa? Citizens here.
It would have been difficult. We have the executive order that puts Iran there. Trump, on the other hand, has talked about how we want to bring in people that are doctors and engineers. We want a different kind of immigration. I know that in some ways it was more difficult because they were very much the minority. They couldn't point to other groups that had this experience. We were in Ohio, and we have to make it. And we don't want the conversation to be too personal. I'll say one area where Trump is not going to fulfill his campaign promise. He's not going to rip up the deal with Iran. He's looking at it. People are advising him. Even Netanyahu is not making that much noise in Israel about how this deal needs to go. Is that some of the criticism of the deal was more a criticism. It was a proxy for unhappiness about Barack Obama. I would be surprised, and I know you'll ask Peter and others, I'd be surprised that deal goes away quickly.
Wow. Okay, so Iran and China on the agenda on the other side of news. John Ratzan, Peter Galbraith continue with us this morning as we talk about what America First means, what President Trump actually means when he talks about that, how we voters with all of our different backgrounds and experiences hear it, and how it is interpreted overseas as well. 651-227-6000 to join us. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie, KERRI NPR. Back in just a minute to Phil Picardi now. Hey, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says Congress is moving ahead with building a wall at the U.S. border with Mexico that would cost $12 to $15 billion. McConnell and House Speaker Paul Ryan did not say how Congress would pay for the wall President Trump has vowed to build. Ryan says he expects a supplemental budget coming from the administration. Ryan says the point is, we're going to finance the Secure Fence Act. President Trump says NAFTA has been a, quote, one-sided deal with jobs and companies suffering as a result. The president's tweet is directed at Mexico and comes a day after he said he would jumpstart construction of a border wall and cut federal grants for sanctuary cities that protect immigrants. Trump referred to a meeting he has planned next week with Mexico's president, saying if Mexico is unwilling to pay for the wall, it would be better to cancel the meeting. Britain's minister for leaving the European Union has introduced a bill on triggering Article 50, which will launch Britain's exit, or Brexit, from the 28-nation bloc. Prime Minister Theresa May's government was forced to place the matter before Parliament after a Supreme Court ruling earlier this week. Six people have been hurt in a shooting at a memorial in Chicago. Police say the shooting happened last night on the city's south side during a vigil for another victim of gun violence. Among those wounded was the mother of the person being remembered. A 16-year-old boy and a 20-year-old woman were hospitalized in serious condition. And a federal judge is declaring Ohio's new lethal injection process unconstitutional. The ruling follows a week-long hearing over the three-drug method Ohio planned to start using next month. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:37.
Well, you've been hearing about Indivisible. It's this new public radio national call-in show tonight. Tonight it comes from Minnesota Public Radio, 7 o'clock with me. I'm going to be taking your calls. We're going to be talking about identity and why demonizing others who voted for somebody else doesn't get us any closer to cohesiveness and a better democracy. That's my angle. Call in tonight at 7 o'clock, and please listen and tweet and tell me what you think.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11 on NPR News, two iconic restaurants at the top of the downtown Minneapolis Macy's building will close tomorrow. We regale in that dining history. We're also going to look back at 25 years ago today when the Super Bowl was in Minneapolis. Join us at 11.
ClimateCast is supported by Benjamin Franklin Plumbing. Together with Mike Rowe, Benjamin Franklin Plumbing supports skilled plumbers who have the tools and expertise to get the job done right the first time. Benjamin Franklin Plumbing, the punctual plumbers, 877-BEN-1776.
Back to our conversation now. Peter, I want to come to you on what John said about the Iran deal. Do you agree with him? It's a lot of rhetoric, but in the end, President Trump won't tear it up?
I think John's right, actually. Trump's nominees have been, particularly General Mattis, have been supportive of the Iran deal. And the debate, and John, I think, very helpfully made this point, that the debate about the Iran deal in the United States had very little to do with Iran. It was the Republicans wanting to get at Obama. Frankly, it had very little to do with Iran. And in Israel, it was Netanyahu seeing an issue that he could use in elections. And I was in Iran at the time the deal was being negotiated. The debate in Iran had very little to do with the United States. It was really an issue between the hardliners and the supreme leader on one hand, and Rouhani, the president, and Zarif, the foreign minister, on the other. Because when you go beyond that and look at the merits, and all of those debates are overtaken by events, the deal is makes a lot of sense. So one hopes that he won't tear it up. I do want to say, though, I think he's we talk about immigrants and people having visas. I mean, it's clear that John's parents couldn't come here now because Trump is saying nobody from Iran going to be able to get a visa.
John was admitted off air. He was dodging me on that, Peter. But so I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. So I mean that's completely clear. And nobody can deny that there's a bias against Muslims. I don't know if John is Muslim or not, but there clearly is a bias there. And this is a case of something that actually could be very destructive to our foreign policy, because one of the things that's very clear if you go to Iran is that the Iranians are among the most pro-American people in the world. And also they're very openly critical of the regime, many of them. And one of the reasons is that there's been such, even though there have been no diplomatic relations with Iran since 1979, there's been this complete flow of people between the two countries. They refer to Los Angeles in Iran as Tehrangeles. And so if you cut that off, end up doing something that in the end may be quite harmful to the United States and quite harmful to the prospects, I even think the likelihood of change in Iran in the coming years.
John, what do you think?
Carrie, I don't know whether it makes good radio when your guests are agreeing as much as we have. I'm going to agree again with Peter, and I'll take it to another point. Where this go-it-alone America first can set us back is in counterterrorism. I think the average American does not realize how much cooperation we get from our allies. And if our allies don't like what we're doing in other areas of foreign policy, if they think that we're adopting a discriminatory or a prejudiced set of policies against people here, they're not going to give us those tips and leads. We even get cooperation from countries that are not necessarily our allies. There's so much cooperation among intelligence services that are gathering information for us, for themselves, and then they share it with us, that speak the languages, that understand the places where ISIS and al-Qaeda thrive. And if Trump goes too far with this America first, it will affect those relationships that we have in Europe and in the Middle East, the behind the scenes, the in the shadows type of deals that are necessary to do counterterrorism. Trump is a deal maker. I don't think he understands the kind of deals that are necessary behind closed doors to confront these enemies that are coming at us.
A call here from Melissa in St. Paul. And hi, Melissa. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What are you thinking about?
You know, just when I hear America first, I think I take a different stance than what I keep hearing on the media. And I hear hope. And I don't think that it's isolation, and I don't think that it's egoism or anything like that. I look at it as though it's our government trying to maybe replace or appeal some of the different policies that are set in place, especially when it comes to international. I'm a military family. My husband served 20 years in the Air Force and just retired. And so we lived internationally. Mm-hmm. We were forced to live in Italy. And I think that replacing some of the career politicians and some of the policies that just kind of rolled over from decade to decade, my personal experience of living over there, Americans are very much taken advantage of, both financially as well as kind of legally over there. Just for an example, we are forced to live in the community, meaning we have to pay the local Italians for rent. We are paid we're made to pay a much higher rent. We're made to pay a much higher utility bill. For example, we paid directly our landlord, an Italian national, for utilities for the first 6 months that we lived there, and then we were forced to switch over to our own, and our utility bills doubled simply because we were Americans.
Melissa, forgive me. I have a lot of other people that would like to get in on this. Do you have a question, or do you want to sum up your comment for our guests? I think I have a sense of what you're saying, that you don't see this in a negative way, and your experience with your husband in the military informs that view. Is that right? Oh, I might have lost Melissa there. Shoot. Okay. John, do you want to say anything about Melissa's experience here?
I hear Melissa saying something that goes into the beginning of our conversation. I think it's sometimes difficult for the elite, for the media, for professors, for the foreign policy establishment to understand how Trump resonates with other areas. It was difficult for the pollsters. And what I noticed, I went to the rally here at my son's suggestion before the election day. And I noticed that the police there were very much in favor of Trump. They were supposed to be doing security. They had their cameras out taking pictures. There were lots of military families there, mm-hmm. people that had served, workers. And they connected with Trump in a way that I think professors and the elite do not. And you heard today the chief of staff saying that his foreign policy is about American workers.
Right.
We have to recognize that he did well in places where Democrats used to do well. Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin. It can't all be a show. It can't be a charade. It's got to connect with some aspects of our society.
Justin says here from Indiana, it's naive to think America first means anything else other than self-interest first. It's playing on Americans' dissatisfaction. It's a short-term goal. I wanted to, John, ask you and Peter about something that Richard Haass says in his new book, A World in Disarray. He's head of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he's saying he thinks the way the United States should view Russia and China is basically turn down the the temperature and the volume on this, and don't exaggerate the friction between the two countries. And he says, Russia's behavior in Ukraine is not the first phase of a bid for global domination, any more than is China's behavior in the South China Sea. Rather, each has political and security-related concerns that can be influenced and shaped. Peter, would you speak to China specifically first on that?
Well, I think Richard Haass's observation is exactly right. What is the South China Sea? What we're talking about is a bunch of rocks, which conceivably could have petroleum hydrocarbons underneath it, but there's no evidence of it, and the hydrocarbons wouldn't make a huge difference to China's economy. This is basically a political issue. There's no great national security interest for the United States, or to be honest, for the surrounding countries. They aren't going to build a wall in the middle of the sea. Coming to Russia and Ukraine, there's also a very specific history here. There was an elected president of Ukraine from the pro-Russian party in Ukraine. He made a deal. There had been a deal with the EU. He decided not to go forward with it, make one with Russia. There were protests against that. And the Russians repeatedly said to the United States and the Europeans, stay out of this. We didn't. The Europeans didn't. The Russians said, well, actually, we can do something about it. And once the president, who was a total crook, was overthrown, the Russians seized Crimea, which incidentally was 90% Russian, and that was almost certainly the will of most of the people who lived there. So to see that as the first step in an effort to rebuild the Soviet Union or take the Baltics, I think it's a very mistaken view. And we got into a lot of trouble doing that during the Cold War, when, for example, we saw Afghanistan as a aggressive move toward the warm water port rather than a very complicated internal situation where a revolution took place that they didn't anticipate, and then a bunch of very geriatric men in the Kremlin decided to help it. And to look at China in the same way, where is China actually going to expand politically? The only places it could possibly have influence are places where there are Chinese populations, and that is a very small world. There isn't a pro-China sentiment in Thailand or in East Africa. Yes, they can have a lot of aid programs there, but they aren't going to be running up the red flag.
Okay,
we shouldn't be so concerned about all of this.
I want to come back to you, John, and you kind of went, you're not so sure about what Peter just said. But I also want to ask you about how China, there have been some remarks coming out of China, and you know that China, the premier showed up in Davos because, again, they're perceiving if America is going to, and I know this is much more nuanced than this, but if America is going to withdraw a bit, maybe there's an opportunity here. Maybe there's a bit of a vacuum for China to step in. How do you think it's being seen there?
You asked us to focus on Russia and China. And if you're going to ask me, what is the first incident that we may have? If I accept Peter's notion that President Trump is tempestuous, that he's easily provoked, then I'm much more concerned about provocation coming from China. I think the Russian leadership, they're going to give Trump some time. They're going to play with Trump. They think that they can reach some kind of accommodation that's consistent with their interests as described. And Russia has more of a history and more of a potential. I agree with Peter there for being a global power.
So what does the provocation then from China look like?
That South China Sea that we're making fun of, it may only be some rocks, but that may be enough. Or Taiwan. And China, they depend on this trade, this flow. And if they feel that Trump is going too far, I believe that they will test him in some way. And I wonder what the reaction will be. If we're going to get a true test of the president, I think it's much more likely to come from China than it is Russia in the short term, in the next few months.
Call here from John in Woodbury. Hey, John, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi. What'd you want to say?
My concern about America First is that it's all about jobs
and it's all about a bright future. My concern is that with the employment rate, it doesn't take into effect, like into account, the mentally ill, the prisoner, the felon. It doesn't take into effect people who have been pushed out of society but want to be back into society. And we, you know, all these companies are lying about needing visas for other, you know, bringing other foreign workers.
So, John, hold on one second. It sounds like you're applying American First to a domestic policy, but I have to say that today we are focused on international policy beyond our borders. Perhaps we'll talk about that on another time, but and I hope you'll be listening for that. Call here from Tom in Minneapolis. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hey. I'm just thinking about, you know, it seems to me that in the past, a lot of the power the United States had on the global scene not only came from our military or economic strength, but also our commitment to high ideals like human rights, democracy. And I just wonder how Trump's rhetoric, if interpreted internationally as not fulfilling or fully embodying those values, might affect our leverage.
What do you think, John?
I think the average American underestimates what it takes to export democracy, to export human rights. And in our idealism, we sometimes get ourselves into trouble or we make a situation worse. We talked about Iran, the country where my parents come from. President Carter put pressure on the Shah to reform. I think most people looking back would say that with all the abuses that occurred under the Shah, that was better for U.S. interests and arguably better for the Iranian people than what came afterward, the revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran. If we look, and we've talked about it before here, at the Arab Spring, we were so encouraged by this potential for democracy in a part of the world that did not have democracy for a long, long time. And what we've ended up with is something that is much worse, disorder. Then stability that may have some abuses, but stability with abuses is still better than disorder. I agree that we should try to export our ideas, but let's be careful. It's not like taking some sapling, putting it in the soil, and you're going to have democracy and human rights. If it were that easy, we would have had democracy and human rights around the world a lot sooner.
Peter, I want to play something from a campaign speech that then-candidate Trump gave, and this is where he talks about, and I'm sure you remember this theme, that the United States has been humiliated for a long time abroad, and it's really time to redress that. So listen to the way he put it.
We've let our rivals and challengers think they can get away with anything, and they do. They do. At will, it always happens. If President Obama's goal had been to weaken America, he could not have done a better job.
Peter, is that what happened under President Obama? Which is a big question, and we've talked about Obama's foreign policy in depth. But overall, do you take Trump's point?
No.
Okay.
In fact, when Obama came into office, U.S. prestige around the world was at an all-time low after Bush with Iraq and the failure there. And Obama certainly brought back American prestige and certain respect for America around the world. I mean, one evidence of it was that they awarded him the Nobel Peace Prize for the simple act of not being George Bush. So,
right.
I don't think that is an accurate criticism. But I think John made a point, and I think it needs to be made more broadly, which is that we assume that events around the world are under our control. We were not responsible for the Arab Spring. Frankly, we weren't responsible for Khomeini and what happened in Iran. We have an idea that we are responsible for all these things, when in fact we aren't. But I don't have a problem. In fact, I'm supportive of the idea that the United States ought to be standing with the side of democracy and human rights. I thought we were wrong in the Reagan years when we supported the white South African government and were not interested in a majority rule. I thought we were wrong to support the Pinochet dictatorship. And, you know, the world is better off without Pinochet, without the white South Africans, without the Soviet Union. But, you know, we didn't get rid of the Soviet Union. Reagan didn't. Kennedy didn't. It was really Gorbachev and what happened within Russia, those internal dynamics. So let's stop assuming that the entire world is something that we control. And if it goes badly, it's somehow our fault.
Peter, really a pleasure for the time and the insight and the experience and the conversation. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Peter Galbraith is former U.S. ambassador and author of Unintended Consequences, joining us this morning from Switzerland. John, I want to ask you something because I know you think broadly about these ideas. Tonight on this call-in show that I'll be doing, I'm going to be talking about the misconceptions and the information gap that we have about other people who voted for someone else. So we fall quickly to distorted stereotypes on you voted for Donald Trump, so you must be fill in the blank. And I think this contributes to this identity distortion that we have and this misinformation. And there's no real way to bring that together, to bring some cohesion here, unless we push away some of those distorted stereotypes. And I just love your thought on kind of where I'm going on that tonight and what you think about it.
I think it's the most important conversation that we need to have as a country. And I think most of us need to calm down and listen, breathe, think about what the person in front of us has said. Is that what worries me about this country is how polarized it's become. And if we have some true challenges, we need to come together, whatever it is. What alarms me is the talk so quickly in elite circles. At my law school, among the professors, about impeachment. I don't think we're going to impeach Trump. Of people assuming that because I voted for Trump, I must be a sexist, I must be a bigot, I must have all these other problems. I had many of those problems before. Not those kind of problems, but I had problems before I voted for Trump. Hear what I'm saying about what appealed to me about this candidate. I'm not as alarmed, but I'm not diminishing their concerns. But I said, let's have a conversation. But if you start chanting at me, it's hard for me to do much in return. After 9/11, we came together as a country, and that started to fall apart, and it was Iraq. Iraq became a divide in this country, and we started to shout at each other again. What I love about your program and the other events that you do is you don't allow people to do much shouting. And I think your listeners and the people here, you will look at it from a different angle. So my best advice is to tell everyone in a very mystical way to breathe before they think.
Tune in at 7 o'clock tonight, John. Let me know what you think, all right?
Thank you.
And I'll be looking for you on Twitter and you on the phone lines. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Welcome all views on that. We start at 7.